Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 28 featuring Dariush Darakhshani. Dariush is now a member of Chaos Group and is working with our education and documentation group. And he is a really cool guy. You guys will see that I've become quick friends with him. Really enjoy his company. And we talk about education and we talk about a bunch of other things. We also happen to have a very like-minded sense of humor, which is always fun. And I figured it'd be good to see what's going on. There's actually going to be a bunch of stuff that we're going to talk about in terms of education and in terms of what we're able to do. So keep posted and figure out what those are all about. I also want to do one last note. I'd like to be able to get some ratings of our podcast on iTunes. So if you guys are listening it through iTunes or go to iTunes, please give some of the episodes that you've enjoyed a rating or leave a comment or whatever. I'd like to be able to keep track of those things on iTunes as well. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You wanna put that thing as close as possible. No, it goes this way.
No.
It's an end. Not in your eye. Do not put the microphone in your eye. That's not where you speak from. The microphone.
But I like to watch what I say.
This is exactly.
I hope you're recording that.
I am recording.
Oh, nice. So good. Sounds all right?
Yeah, it sounds good. Just watch what you say. Don't stick the microphone in your eyeball. So we should. I'm gonna opening a shooty. Shooty pop is my third Sprite Zero today.
Yeah, no, I have three Coke Zeros. This is my third. It's addictive, highly addictive.
Yeah. So we had. Obviously, I try to get anyone to get on my podcast because I need to make sure there's rosters that are filled and I have to do one every week. But when we were sitting around, you and I, in Stuttgart, yeah, and we were talking and we were having a grand old time as we always do.
Yeah, it's really fun.
It's really fun to be there, yeah. I think, was it the time when you were telling me that there are potatoes on even in the salad?
Potatoes, yes, that's right. In Germany, they put potatoes on everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Including the salad.
Not get away from carbs.
Which you were trying desperately to do.
At the time, yeah.
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 Are you back on carbs?
A little bit. Yeah. Okay. Then I'll be back off after the fourth.
Oh, is this kind of like off and on again, or is that how it works?
Yeah, yeah. Keep my sanity. If I'm off carbs too long, I go batshit crazy.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Yeah.
Did you see the Portlandia episode when he stopped eating pasta?
You know, I don't watch Portlandia. I don't know why. There's a couple of shows I really have to watch.
They basically made him look like he was a heroin addict going at like pasta shops and trying to get pasta.
It's kind of like that, yeah, actually. First few days of no carbs it's tough.
It is, yeah. I guess. I don't know. I've never had a.
I've never known.
I don't know what a diet is.
and don't. Once you go down the diet route,
I'll take that back. I am a very skinny, tall guy, and I am actually about the heaviest I've ever been right now. I know that sounds weird, but
well, you look wonderful.
Thank you. But I was ridiculously skinny, and when I was a runner. And I was trying to gain weight, and I was speaking to a nutritionist who was working with a sports team, and she was basically saying, well, because you are burning as many calories as you are burning, the only way you can gain weight is through fat, because you put these carbs, you eat all those carbs, but you burn through those carbs instantly, because that's what they're for.
Right.
So you need more long sustaining energy, and the only way to get that through fat. So she basically put me on an 8,000 calorie diet.
Oh my God. That's wonderful.
Yes. And I was eating like a pound of bacon every day.
Wow.
I didn't gain weight.
Wow.
But the problem was I was exhausted from eating. Like yeah. eating is tiring.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a lot of heavy food too.
Mm-hmm. I was eating like big things of peanuts and avocados and whatever right. else I can do.
I was going to suggest the best way to gain a lot of weight is to become a CG artist, but I guess that hasn't worked for you either. For yeah.
No, absolutely. But okay, well, let's go back to that. Cause I was at Colgate. I graduated in 93 from Colgate. When were you at mm-hmm. Lehigh?
89 to 93.
So I graduated, same exact you know, years.
93.
And so I was at Lehigh racing you guys because I was racing.
Oh, really?
At the same time that
oh,
you
nice,
were there.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I would be nowhere near any sort you were, of you weren't running probably whatsoever. Not near. Yeah. I would run from running if I could run.
But it's funny because you were at Lehigh when I was at Colgate.
That's funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Colgate's not too far from Lehigh, is it?
No. You guys are like in, you know, Hershey, Pennsylvania area, right?
Bethlehem. About an hour north of Philly.
Miner's time or steel mill.
Steel mill. Yeah, big time. Bethlehem right. Steel.
Right.
A lot of Carnegie heritage there. Right. Pittsburgh, obviously, as well, but that's right. a few hours east.
Yeah. Yeah. Lehigh is also a very big engineering school, obviously.
Huge. Their mascot actually was the engineer.
Right.
They've changed it to the Mountain Eagle because it's cooler. And the funny thing is it wasn't like a slide ruler engineer. Uh-huh. It was like a train engineer, mm-hmm. which was like super dopey. Super, super dopey. But I guess they got a few marketing people to hire. So now they're a little cooler with the Screaming Eagle or the Desert Eagle, whatever it is.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we were the Red Raiders, which is a little bit racist because obviously it's a Native American.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
a little bit of racism is okay, I guess.
I think you need that in the school system just to remind people of what it was like.
Where you came from, yeah. who you abolished from those lands to make your campus.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes, it's true. And we were in an extremely remote area in upstate New York, the snow belt. It was, you know, snowed all the time over there. But I did have a good time at my education. I think it was around... Geez, I guess around my sophomore year that I remember the realization that went off in my brain that I was at school was no longer just a chore that I had to do.
Right.
It was suddenly, it's right around the time when you start to choose your major, right?
Right, right.
What do you really want to do? And I basically had the freedom to think about what I wanted to do and make some choices in my life.
Right, yeah.
And then I realized, like, I guess I can choose to take classes that I want to take. I don't have to take English and history or whatever else.
Yeah, yeah.
I can focus on math because that's what I like.
Right,
know? And so
right.
There was the realization that I could do that, that all of a sudden I started to realize the power of education, of what it could do. And then when I went to grad school, to me then it was the realization that I wasn't there to try to get a good grade because I know by the time you're in grad school.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're worried about grades when you're in grad school, there's something wrong. Like you're just not getting it.
It's not about
the grade.
Right.
Yeah.
And I started to realize that the teachers, that all the undergraduates were like, oh, I got to make sure I get a good grade from this teacher,
yeah,
blah, blah,
right,
blah, blah, blah.
Right, right, right.
And I was like,
no.
Fuck no.
Just do a good job.
Those teachers are there for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So teaching, I don't want to impress the teachers. I want the teachers to teach me stuff. In fact, I would rather fail over and over in front of the teacher to learn how to be better rather than succeed because I've never made a mistake.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I think failure is the best way to learn something. And you know, I in grad school when I went for animation, you know,
right.
It was all still pretty new as far as CG goes.
Right.
So we had all these professors who were great animators, traditional.
Mm-hmm.
So we would learn concepts and then we would sit down and go through the user manuals, like the old thick... those nasty engineer speak manuals
right.
to figure out how the hell to animate anything.
Right.
And we constantly failed, constantly.
Right.
Nothing would work. And as frustrating as that was at the time, in hindsight, it really was a fantastic education.
Right.
Because you're learning how things work and you're learning how you can get around and make it fit your mold.
Right.
I mean, because, you know, with CG, you can do the same thing 12 different ways and there's no one correct way. It's just what's right for you.
Yeah. So. I've seen that specifically, you know, as an example, when we're working on the WikiHuman project. And part of that is actually to teach people how to do things, right?
Right.
Or figure out what it's like. And several artists are in the group. And if I looked at every one of those artists and I brought back their shaders that they have, every one of them is different. Everyone is completely different. So everyone can approach a problem in a different way.
Totally.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that their way is better or not, just to realize that it's a different way of looking at things.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I really like about education, like higher education in the arts. It's a lot more, especially with architecture, it's a lot more design challenges where you have like a client or a site or something that's looking for a particular design that fits within a larger context. And then you just have to figure it out. Whereas if you have one of these technical educations where it's like, push this button, step two, push that button and flip the switch, you're not learning how to overcome what the greater goal is. You're learning how to push a lawnmower, but you're not really learning how to landscape your yard in a way.
Right.
And that's how I like to approach education. That's why I really valued, because I studied architecture as an undergraduate, as you know, and that's what I really enjoyed about it. It was learning how to design environments for people as opposed to how to draw a line.
Right.
You know, and how to put a window into a wall.
Yeah, I've mentioned this before, but I think the best thing that I learned from architecture school was learning how to learn.
Yeah.
Instead of actually learning how to be an architect.
Yeah, and it's funny how many people we know that studied architecture but are not architects.
It's been kind of an ongoing joke on a podcast. Everyone is like, well, you know, I used to be an architect. It's like, oh, really? Shocking.
Yeah. Right, right. And I enjoy architecture, but I'm glad I'm not in it. You know, it wasn't exactly my field.
Sure, and that's fine. I think that there's a sensibility that you have from the architecture education that is clear, that it comes through. The way that you approach design, the way that you look at problem solving, and even just the conversation I had with Craig Shimahara, who was just here, and I just did a podcast with him, where he basically said... The idea of storytelling, right? Storytelling is such an important part of that process.
Yeah, it totally is.
So so I remember, I was going to tell you a story, but right. So you're a teacher as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I used to teach at Rice University.
Right.
And my first day teaching, I was sort of preparing to do things, and I decided that I didn't want to teach people how to use the software by just pushing buttons, right?
Right.
Do this, do that. And because then they can get that out of a manual. I want to teach them the process of same idea. Like if I teach them how to learn how to do something, then they'll be better at it. But if I teach them exactly the way the software is now, in 2 years from now, their education is obsolete.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Teach them the process of it. So the first thing I decided to do is like, you know what? I'm going to teach Max and Maya at the same time so that they learn the similarities between those two and therefore they'll understand the general concepts. So what I did is I went to the blackboard. I said, first day, we're going to go and teach some general concepts about this. And then we'll practice on a computer and understand what it is. And so I went to the blackboard and I said, all right, there's three ways of moving things or changing something in CG. And that's rotation, translation, and scale. So I do, R, T, S, and I write on a blackboard, and I write down rotation, translation, scale. And I turned around, and I saw everyone writing it down in their notebook.
Right.
And I said, oh, shit. And I freaked out because I realized that everything I say, they're going to listen to.
Yeah.
And they're going to pay attention to it, and I better be right.
Yeah.
And it's a scary thought that all of a sudden, like, oh, if they're going to be listening to you, you better be right. And what I learned from that process was that I learned more by teaching than I did by learning on my own.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I love about teaching is I'm always learning new things. And one of the things I like to challenge my students with is to gain a mastery of something that they're trying to learn themselves is explain it to me, like teach me how to do it or mm-hmm. put it in a format where you're explaining it to somebody. And one of the first things I say in the first day of my classes is look around the room. These are the people that are going to support you. Mm-hmm. These are the people that you should be friendly with and you should be kind to and you should help out because they're your brothers and sisters in arms. And mm-hmm. if you're going into production, you're going to be counting on them and they're going to be counting on you. Mm-hmm. So it's very much a collaboration. And the more you're able to explain what you're doing to your colleague, the right. more you're going to understand it.
Right.
And if you set that as your mindset, you're going to be very successful.
Right.
Because one of the first jobs that I had out of grad school was compositing on Icy and Chalice for Rhythm and Hues way back when on the Flintstones sequel.
Right.
And the hiring manager at the time, I was more of a CG guy, was asking me, you know Chalice, right? And I, yeah, of course I know Chalice, mm-hmm. but I didn't. I knew Eddie, which was a soft homage, but I knew they're both node-based compositors.
Right.
I know how to composite. I kind of know. So I spent the weekend learning it before I started on Monday, and then I really got a lot of help from the people sitting around me whenever I was asking, oh, where's this command or where's this node? Where can I find it? And those people and I were, to this day, were friends. Mm-hmm. And during my, I guess, about 3 months there on that job, by about the second month or so, I was helping other people with what I had learned from the people around me.
Right.
And the more I explain to somebody, yeah, just go over here and do this, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm starting to get it a lot better.
Right.
It's just, it's so, I mean, education is multifaceted. You know, some people learn by reading, some people learn by hearing, some people learn by seeing diagrams and they're more visually oriented. Some people learn by doing. Some people need more than one mode mm-hmm. to learn. So the more you're able to cover yourself, the more perspectives you can get on it. So I think when you intake information, then when you're able to process it and give it to somebody else, that mastery becomes even better for you.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there is a way to look at the education process as a community event, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that's what you're basically describing as well, there where by exchanging ideas back and forth and exchanging knowledge, it's a much better way of kind of working together.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there's a little bit sometimes of a problem with formal education in terms of the idea of the classroom, et cetera, because
it
doesn't always work. It's the practice that really makes the thing work.
Yeah, that's true. And that goes back to what we were saying about grad school is, mm-hmm. you know, if you're still worried about impressing teachers, you know, you should reevaluate why you're in grad school.
Right.
But, you know, making it out of high school into college, you gain this mindset of now I'm doing something for me mm-hmm. as opposed to just going to school because I'm compelled to mm-hmm. and my parents are going to kick the shit out of me if I don't.
Right.
Now it's kind of like I'm setting myself up for a future that I want. And that's kind of the stage developmentally when your brain is actually becoming fully formed at that point where you, reasoning and things like that are becoming actually organically formed in your brain.
Right.
But by grad school, it's like, what do I want to do specifically? What do I want to show and what sorts of skills do I want to have and understandings that I want to be able to present as a professional?
And now that obviously you've gone through that, you've done very similar things that I have in, mm-hmm. in education. You've gone through your undergraduate school. You did your architecture first and then animation. Right. I did my math first and then my art and then my architecture. But what got you compelled to be a teacher? What was some of the things that got you involved in that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I love hearing myself speak. I like giving people advice. I like helping, right?
Sure.
Because I appreciate being helped. And I remember a few times in high school when I was taking calculus class, and for the life of me, I couldn't understand why. Like, I just wanted to, sure, all these equations and all that kind of factoring, and but why? Why was it there? Like, what practical? And I never got that from my teacher. I didn't know to ask. Of course, education is half on you. But I always want to know, you know, why? Why is it there? Why do I have to learn it? And I got a little bit frustrated because some of my teachers weren't really giving me that. Again, I didn't know to ask for it. So when colleagues, when students and friends at school asked me for any sort of help, I would kind of go into the philosophy of, okay, so if you understand the underlying reasons of what this is,
sure,
it'll be a lot easier to grasp the actual tangible numbers and letters and whatever the hell it actually is. And I found that to be really, really exciting because I would see light bulbs go off. And then when I graduated undergraduate school, when I got home to New Jersey, you know, I wanted to find a job because I wanted to get the hell out of my mom's house.
Right.
You know, with all due respect to my mom, who's an awesome, awesome person. But yeah, you want to get out of your house. You want to make your own life. So I just went through the Yellow Pages and I found a place looking for part-time SAT instructors. So I took that. That was a weekend job and I just loved it. It was a lot of fun. I did some TAing as an undergraduate and that was fun as well. Mm-hmm. But then when I got into grad school, I applied to be a TA. And then after grad school, after a couple of years, I started teaching at the Art Institute. And the dean at the time, really, really cool. She's an awesome person. She's like, you'll be teaching 3D Studio Max. And I said, well, I'm a Maya guy. I know Max a little tiny bit. She's like, well, you'll figure it out.
Right.
You know, I got confidence in you. And I did. And the students in that class, I mean, we got along really well. And it just kind of clicked. So in essence, I've been teaching professionally since I was 21,
right,
and about 20 years off and on. And then a few years ago, I had an opportunity to teach more fully at a few places here in LA. And I decided to don't actively go for production work and focus more on teaching and, you know, do some set supervision here and there whenever I can.
But you obviously do have production experience. You've been working in productions for years.
Yeah, about 17 years.
17 years you've been working in production. So you're bringing that knowledge to the teaching part of things.
Yeah, yeah. I think I've been teaching, I've been working production about 17 years. I've been teaching animation and film stuff for about 15 or so. Mm-hmm. Always had one night class, would never ever let it go because it was the thing I wanted to do.
Right.
After, you know how the days can be with production jobs.
Sure.
You know, your 12 hour days, 6 day weeks.
Yeah.
But every time I would go to class after those 3 hours, I would feel like I just took a really long sleep. Mm-hmm. I'd feel energized, I'd feel awake, and I knew that was the thing. So I think I made a pretty good decision to kind of teach more fully and devote my time to writing and education.
Right. And you've actually written as well. You've done a couple of books, right?
Yeah. I have Introducing Maya and 3D S Max Essentials, which I co-write with my wife. Mm-hmm. Those, so far, I'm lucky to say, they've been in new editions every year. My Maya book goes back to 99, I think, or 2000.
Are you serious?
It's been in print since about 2000, maybe 2001.
Okay.
But it's had 13 editions.
Right.
So far, I've been really lucky for it.
So you've had to update it constantly.
Yeah, yearly. Basically, what the publishers have asked me to do, because teachers use this as a resource, they don't want the stuff to change a lot year to year because they want to plan their courses.
Right.
So every other book, I change at least 50 to 60% of it.
Right.
But every year I update it, make fixes, change the UI stuff.
Right.
But every other year I make a clean sweep of a lot of the exercises. Mm-hmm. So they're fresh, but I'm still teaching the same topics. And that we literally are in the last stages of the 2016 versions of both those books right now, proofing PDFs and stuff. It's hellish at times, you know, after the day you come home, you got to work some more, but it's really nice to get that book and open it and just smell pages, I'm kind of a dinosaur, in that way, but, you can't smell an ebook. Really?
It's not. It doesn't pet you back.
No. No, it doesn't. And you can't hide stuff in ebooks. Yep. But it's cool. Publishing's been really kind to us, and has helped out teaching as well.
Right.
And that whole book started because back when I was teaching Maya, I think it was the closest book was Mastering Maya 2. It was on version 2. It was like an 800-page book. Mm-hmm. And, I'm teaching introductory classes. I don't want to give out an 800-page book. So I came up with about a 350-page book.
Right.
That Wiley, my publisher, picked up on. And it's now about 400 pages. So it still keeps in with people who want to dabble and get into it. Mm-hmm. And it's just exactly where I want it to be.
Right.
Because I get a lot of people that are like, I want to dabble. I want to check into it. And people don't realize this sort of medium is very communication heavy. And, I really think everything computationally is going to be 3D. I think I would love to see my desktop be an Unreal or a Unity world where with like mouse actions, I can go in Z in my desktop and not just have it be this flat table, but be able to walk down the hall and get to, my documents here, or open this door and go right and get to my games, or go further down, sort of thing. So, CG is such a large part of the lexicon.
Right.
And I think generationally it's going to be just another way of talking to each other and presenting information.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it. And I think, CG is an interesting field in general. And it's obviously the field that you've been teaching for a long time. Mm-hmm. And you now have a Chaos Group email. So you are actually part of the Chaos Group
team. I am part of the team, yeah.
And you are part of our education department or group. What is it? You're part of the education program.
Yeah, basically. I've been consulting with Chaos for over a year now on
you've been doing
training. You've been doing training.
Your voice is on a few of the videos.
Right.
You've done a few of the videos. You are very good, which is why we always have used you, at bringing down the information to a digestible level that is very good to illustrate. So it's like, just to do this, you just need to do this.
And
go through that process.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
And so you've obviously become part of, because of your knowledge of education and everything else, you've come on board as part of our education group and working with Maria, obviously.
Yeah. Maria, I'm really thankful to her for bringing me in a while back. She has a really kind of a good long-term vision and has a great appreciation for how people need to learn and pick this up. And, same thing with Lon too. He has a really good vision on how to get V-Ray more in the hands of people that can use it to their own abilities. Because, it's a tool that speaks volumes when you know what your goal is, when you know what your objective is.
I remember specifically one of the importance about the education. I remember at one point I was asking Peter, you guys are working on a certification program.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Well, we're kind of amending and revising the existing programs.
But basically it allows people to say, yes, if you know all this, I can testify that this person knows enough about the software.
That's exactly right.
Right. So it is an important part of that idea. Now, I asked Peter, the CEO of the company, he's like, why would you need a certification program? I've never hired someone based on the fact that they're certified. This is in Los Angeles.
And he says, of course.
He says, well, Chris, you know, look, he says, you're in LA, you're working on a movie. And he says, I need two lighters. I'm going to hire Bob and Peter because I know Bob and Peter.
Right.
And so they're certified because I've worked with Bob.
Because you know them. Yeah, exactly.
And so that's what happens, right? And that becomes that. Now, in other places, there are thousands of people. Like, let's say in India, in his example.
Oh, yeah.
Thousands and thousands of people. And being able to generally say that this person knows the software is much harder to do in that situation. So a certification program makes complete sense.
Yeah, it really goes a long way. Plus also culturally, there's, you know, the Eastern cultures are a little bit more, they're different in how they view education, and the formalization of education usually culminates in a degree, a diploma, a certification that kind of proves you've been through it, that you know what you're doing.
Right.
In addition just to the mass numbers, there's the fact of proving yourself through that formal education that you can do it, that you've been through it.
Right.
So certification to that's very important. But, you know, you and I have been in leadership positions in production before. You wouldn't dream of hiring somebody that you couldn't get at least some sort of referral out of.
Right.
Yeah. And that's how certifications are seen in a lot of the other markets.
It's kind of like a formal referral.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's very important to us because we want to make sure that the certification means something, that you're actually able to do the things that you're being certified for, and that you not only know just the few buttons that you've got to press to get somewhere, but why you're getting there and why you want to do it in this way and what are the most efficient ways to do it. Because, you know, anybody can pick up a mouse and read a book and pass a test.
Right.
But not that many people would be able to do that in a production setting.
Sure.
And you know, production, you have to be a detective. You got to hunt down what's not working. You got to hunt down what's the best way, what's the fastest way. You know, the way I like to put it is I always have to put 30 pounds of shit in a 20-pound bag.
Right.
You know, and figuring out how to do that isn't really book smarts. It's a lot of production smarts. And
sure.
Part of our process with the certification is how do we fold that in? How do we make it so it's not just did you read the text and did you memorize these values and numbers? Mm-hmm. How do we work in that sense of production knowledge, that sense of you can open a scene and you can get around? So when you take your certification to a potential employer, whatever market you're in, they will know, okay, they know how to open the scene. They know how to debug noise. They know how to make the renders efficient. So that's been one of our top goals for these programs, is to make sure that certifications really mean something to production.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when we were at FMX, FMX is obviously one of the events that we go to. It's one of the big events.
Where they have a lot of potatoes.
They have a lot of potatoes.
A lot of potatoes there.
And beer.
And beer.
And beer. And, yeah. and schnitzel.
Although this year, it was all red wine for me, you know, the carb thing. Oh, so I missed the beer this year. That and the wonderful flights of scotch that we had.
We did a lot of scotch while we were there.
Wonderful scotch tasting.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what we have always seen FMX as, because of the nature of that particular conference, is we see it as the opportunity for us to talk about education and about people in that field. So you were attending it under that pretense of being about education.
Right, right.
And can you tell us a little bit about what was going on over at FMX with you guys and some of the things you were talking about?
Yeah, totally, totally. We had an educator's breakfast
that
we held. Again, a breakfast that I couldn't partake in because of all the potatoes. Fucking potatoes. but we started talking to educators. We invited a number of people to come, and I'm very happy to say that they all came and they all stayed and nobody fell asleep. It was a great event. Vasil and Maria and I were talking to all these educators about some of the initiatives that, that we're working on. And part of the training program goal is not just for the certification, but also to make it easier for educators to teach, because part of the, a lot of the time that I spend prepping my classes is in making assets and coming out with scenes. And it's a giant pain in the ass.
Yeah, when I did my Noman training DVDs, it was like 75% of my time was making the material for that scene.
Right. So when you go to a professor or an instructor and say, how would you like to fold V-Ray in, or what are the ways that V-Ray could be helpful for your classes? We want to open the door so it's not like, okay, well, now I got to fucking spend 8 weeks building a whole bunch of stuff and building 15 weeks of assets and classes. So part of the training program with Maria has been to kind of make stuff for educators to be able to
give them resources.
To give them resources, exactly. So, you know,
not just the book, but give them the scene files.
give them scene files. Give them some videos too, because you know, with all these software, as good as anybody is, there's stuff you don't know.
Right.
You know, there's always emerging new tech too. So we'll put up videos and say, you know, when I'm talking about the skin shader to my classes, I'm going to talk about this, I'm going to talk about that, and give those videos to the educators so they can feel more experienced and more comfortable with this knowledge. So when they teach their classes, they have a, they don't have to have worked at a place doing this for months at a time to feel more grounded.
That's great.
Yeah, no, it was received really very well, and we're working very diligently in Sofia and to build that program. It's a big undertaking, and it is without a doubt something that I know a lot of other places are going to look at, and we're going to be the envy of a lot of organizations for this kind of thinking.
Right. Well, that's really, really cool. I know that the certification that you guys are coming up with is actually kind of challenging, actually.
Yeah.
You actually were doing a test, like to see how much to push it, and you made Daniel Buck take the test. Now, Daniel Buck is not necessarily a newbie to V-Ray.
He is not a newbie, for sure.
He think maybe got an 80%. Maybe
he was on the passing side, if I remember correctly, but barely so.
Yeah.
And when there was a version of the test that I had created here, and then that went to Vasil in Sofia, really good artist, really good educator, and they worked on it over there with Maria's team some more. And then I took the exam again when I went to visit in Sofia, and then I felt like, while I was taking the test, I felt like I may not pass this, you know. And obviously, there's stuff I don't know.
Right.
So that's where we want it. You know, that's kind of where we're looking.
You want to make sure that people like really know their stuff, right?
Yeah. When you walk into a firm, you know, like Gensler, you know, if you bring in a chaos stamped certification, we want it to mean that you can sit down and you can figure it out.
Right.
You know, that it's not hollow. We want to put a lot of weight to it. Obviously, as well, we don't want to make it out of reach for people. We don't want it to be necessarily or unnecessarily complicated that people are like, oh my God, I'm never going to pass this. But we want to know that you have a breadth of knowledge and experience to some extent that will prove to somebody, you're going to make it through the day, you know, and be able to deliver what you say. A little bit like some of the Adobe certifications are fairly broad and fairly well tasked, so that you kind of know a lot about Illustrator or Photoshop or After Effects, not just one vertical market where, you know, you can do puppet animation, but you can't do a Luma key.
Right.
You know, that you need to know a little bit about everything, so that when a shop picks you up, you can do it.
Yeah.
And we want to take that a little bit further. And
that's true because, you know, the thing is that I think that the generalist mentality is coming back.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea of the specialist, the person that just does lighting. I mean, it used to get so broken down to, oh, this person is a hard surface modeler, this person right. is a character modeler.
Yeah, yeah.
And they used to separate out those two things, and they don't do that anymore.
No, not so much. Unless you're still in a really big place, but there aren't that many really big places anymore.
No, and even the big places are starting to see that. I mean, yeah. If you look at, you know, ILM, their matte painting department has now been renamed the generalist department.
Yeah,
and they're it's big. They're doing a lot of things there,
right?
And you know, a lot of that's working. And the fact is that there's enough generally good artists that can do a lot on their own.
Yeah,
and it helps. Like if you model the knowing that you're going to texture it yourself, knowing that you're going to shade it yourself, that you need to. You build everything based on the way you want to work.
Right.
And yeah. It goes faster. So you don't, well, I better model more than I need to because I don't know how they're actually going to use this or whatever.
Yeah, right, you know?
So
right.
So it becomes more efficient that way.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I've been a generalist my entire career.
Right.
Mostly commercials. And
well, you wrote the Maya book is talking about generally everything, right?
Yeah, yeah. It covers A to Z, you know. Because right. When you're going to make your own project, you got to know a little bit of everything, you know, sure. to do that. And that's really where it's at. You know, if you want to get a job, you can get a job, you know, that's, but if you know how to do something for yourself, that's a lot more fulfilling of an education. You know, I could sit down and make my own short, you know, the sure. animation would be horrible because I suck at animation, but right. you know, I would know the processes of start to finish.
Right.
And I think that's much more gratifying. And I think people would tend to pay more attention to that. Now, having said that, it's always important when you're starting off your education is to focus one step at a time.
Sure.
You know, and take it in processes where, you know, I have a lot of people ask me, what should I learn? And should I learn Blender? Should I learn Maya? Should I learn Mac? Should I get into this? Should I get into that? Like, just pick one and then learn how to make a project.
Right.
You know, make yourself a little short and, you know, it's going to be crappy in the beginning.
Right.
And then it gets less crappy and less crappy and less crappy.
Well, that was kind of the thing that I was doing when I was at Rice and I was teaching people how to do Max and Maya at the same time.
Yeah.
I figured, here's how you move something in Max. Here's how you move something in Maya. And then if they picked up Blender, like, oh, well, where's the move tool? And they know what to look for.
Right.
Because they've already gone through it on the two other ones. They already know the similarities of what to look for. And it's not like I only know how to do it this one way.
So right, exactly.
It helps to have that.
Yeah, it's like the saying, give a man a fish, you feed him for the day, teach him how to fish, and you know he'll take over your job and wreck your industry and force you to move to Vancouver. Right. bitter much?
Yeah. Indeed. Let's see. There's another story I want to talk to you about because I think what we're going to do is the picture that's going to go up on the podcast of you is going to be the picture of you with all of the lanyards.
I had no idea what things would spark from that photo.
So I'm going to tell the story and then you can fill in the parts. But I went to SIGGRAPH last year and as I got my badge, they walked me back. I was like, well, do you have any ribbons? I said, I don't know. Do I? It's like, well, are you a speaker? I said, actually, I am, because I happened to be a speaker that year.
Right, right.
I happen to be a speaker this year. I'm a speaker every now and then. I forgot I was a speaker this year. So they said, well, go over there, get your thing. And so they come up to me. It's like, all right, well, what are you speaking? I was like, I'm speaking at Real Time Live. I was like, okay, here's your Real Time Live ribbon. So it's a little thing that goes on the bottom.
Yeah.
And I said, so, and then they gave me another one. So this is one just for being a speaker. And when was your first SIGGRAPH? And I said, I don't know. I guess it was 1995 or whatever. So then I got a 1995
right,
ribbon.
Right.
And then there might have been one other one, and they basically had like four ribbons. I was like, oh, check it out. I got four ribbons.
Right, right, right.
And so I went to Dariush, and Dariush, of course, was mocking me with my paraphernalia.
I had you know, we've gotten to know each other much over the last several months at I think this was one of the first times we spent a good amount of time together in Vancouver, and I had a media ribbon on mine because I was covering the event for Randy Altman for Post Perspective.
Right.
And so you saw my badge, you got a ribbon there. And I'm like, he's like, I remember way back when, you know, ribbons were kind of impressive and you wanted to get all the ribbons, but you know, now it's kind of meh. You got a couple of ribbons on your own. So we had a pretty good rapport. And I'm like, I got to mess with Chris as much as I possibly can. I went to where they hand out the ribbons over by the exhibition, and there was this sweet lady there, and I asked her, you know, could I get as many ribbons as humanly possible? I'm screwing with one of my colleagues, and I want to, and she got this stern look on her face, like she's going to beat me with a ruler, and she's like, you know what? You know, these are serious, and you know, I'm not just going to start handing them out for no reason, and I'm like, well, you know, I deserve a couple, so let's talk about that. And we went through, you know, I was a Seagraph at 95 and this and that and whatever. So I ended up walking away with probably four other ribbons.
Right.
And then, you know, I walked away and I kept my eye on that area. And when I saw her leave, I went straight, beelined it. And this younger volunteer was manning the booth, gave her the same story. I didn't show her the badges that I already gotten, gave her the same story. And she's like, well, let's see what we can do to help you. And I think I got another eight from her, stuck them all together. And it must have been about 2.5 feet long.
It's very long.
It's very, very long. And I stuck them to my badge and I rolled them all up behind my badge. And I'm like, now I have to find Chris. And I went everywhere, all over the floor. Where's Chris? Where's Chris? Every time I saw somebody V-Ray, I'm like, have you seen Chris? They're like, no. So finally, I went back to my hotel room. We were going to have dinner that night. And I'm like, fuck it. I'm just going to take a selfie with all these ribbons unfurled in their grand glory and send it to Chris because I could not find you anywhere. And it was the last AC graph too, right. So...
Yeah, you had that picture had me roaring, and it still cracks me up. It's on my phone, and it'll be your picture.
Yeah.
And it basically, what it reminded me of is the old Soviet Union generals. You know, they had so many medals that you couldn't understand what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
It was so funny. It was so funny. And it was the exact right thing to do with me. And we were back at Stuttgart. We were doing the same thing. We were sending each other photos of random things
that we found. Oh my God. Like pictures of
potatoes or random things we saw in bathrooms.
No, I saw a swing set in a bathroom. What the hell? This is pretty kinky. Of course, it was, you know, disabled access. Sure. So I'm the asshole here, but.
Still. Like they have swings in the bathroom.
They like to frolic. So, and eat potatoes.
And eat potatoes.
But yeah, no, that was really, really tremendous time.
FMX?
Yeah.
FMX. I'd never been. That was my really first. Nice. Was that your first FMX? No, it was not.
It was
your
my
first.
Second. Yes, second FMX.
That's right. You were telling me that.
Yeah.
So, it was my first one. So I really enjoyed it a great deal. You know what? The thing is that a lot of times, especially my younger career, I only basically focused on Siggraph. I only knew about Siggraph.
Yeah,
I didn't
me too.
Than anything else. And so going to some of these other events have been very enlightening to me. When I went to Mundos Digitalis in Spain, I was like, whoa, look at this. This is incredible. I was a speaker there. So that was a nice opportunity.
Right, yeah.
Trojan Horse was a unicorn.
Yeah, I would kill to go to
that. Well, it's all sold out.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, that event is insane. Very, very unique. And I think that's really great that there's these new formats they're doing. And they all serve their purpose, right?
Mm-hmm.
Siggraph, one of the guys at DD, big supervisor there, hates Siggraph. He hates it. He says, oh, it's useless. It was so much better in the old days when it all made sense, and now it's useless. And I said, you know, I think you're wrong about that because some of the most important research papers in our field come out for cigarette. So it is extremely important for the research that we do.
Right, right.
So that's the real reason behind it. Now, it has gotten a lot smaller in terms of attendance.
Yeah.
But it's still an unbelievably important event.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's much less celebratory than it used to be. It's much less check out this awesome industry and how cool everybody is. And it's getting back down to just sharing information. And, and that's what these things are really supposed to be. Although I really do miss the half-naked dancers at those lavish, crazy parties. 10, 15 years ago.
There was a time. Okay, so the last really big cigarette I remember, ironically, was not in L.A. It was in New Orleans, right? So 2000, New Orleans.
I bet.
It was insane. Okay, so some of the things that happened, and my wife went maybe, so this was, that was her first cigarette.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a high bar to set for your first.
Yeah, so she was like crazy town. Like the booths were two stories tall with dancers on top. Wow. It was insane, right?
Yeah.
Some of the things I remember, one was there was literally naked ladies walking around because they were advertising for the texture program body paint. So they were naked with just body paint on them,
right,
walking around. And I was lying to my, I was like, I just saw a naked lady. It's like, yeah, whatever.
Your wife is very proud of you.
Yeah, she's very proud. And the other thing that I remember, and I think it was Sun Systems.
Uh-huh.
They had a booth where they had like an aquarium that was probably about 12 feet. I don't know, maybe 3 meters long or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And inside of it was an animatronic dolphin. So it was a full-on dolphin that was moving around inside this tank.
Right.
On the show floor, right? And then so I was like, that is pretty crazy because it looked like a dolphin, right? But it had a big tube coming out of it, you know, because it's like an animatronic, right?
Right.
And so I walked by the next day, and there was like two pita trucks that were in front of the cigarette booth, and they had apparently tried to like bust them for having a dolphin in a teeny tank.
Yeah, nice, nice.
So yeah.
Well, good for pita for showing up, but that is still pretty damn funny.
It is very funny.
Yeah, we had the same, went to Burning Man with a bunch of friends, and our camp was a giant trap.
Uh-huh.
And we had a giant sign out front that said, free puppies, it's not a trap. And we would invite people to come in for the free puppies. So we had a couple of rangers come by and say, we just want to make sure you don't have a bunch of puppies in here that you're giving out. We're like, no, we don't. Yeah, so I appreciate that. But it's also fun to make fun of.
Yes,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, taking it too seriously. But I'm also glad that, you know.
No, that's even funnier. That's when it's even better. Right. Like their animatronic was so good, even though it had a giant cord coming out of its belly, that it brought in the animal rights activists. Same thing happened, I think, at DD when they were working on the – I think we mentioned on another podcast, but when they were working on the Oh Brother, We're Out Now,
uh-huh.
and they were shooting the cows. And was like, oh,
right.
I think the animal rights activists came in and we had to prove to them that those were not real cows.
It was kind of hard to prove that, wasn't it? Because it looked really good.
Well, you had to show like the wireframe or something.
Yeah, right.
Or whatever it was. But yeah, it's pretty funny.
That's great.
Yeah, those are interesting, interesting times. So – in terms of events and stuff, FMX is obviously passed. Is there other big things that you're going to be focusing on where people can learn more about education that are coming up, you think about?
Well, definitely we're going to be talking at SIGGRAPH.
Okay.
You know, we're putting together the plans for that. That's the next big thing coming up.
Yep.
So there's much to do. You know, there's several weeks left between now and then, and we've got a pretty good roadmap set up for it.
And I know Maria has been talking to me about it. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the fact that I wanted to do a podcast with you about education. And I want to continue that as a theme because I think that as we go along, it'd be cool to talk about different ideas of where education can go or what you guys are doing or things like that. So she definitely wants to do one sometime around SIGGRAPH.
Yeah, I also just generally want to heckle all your other podcasts and just cut in and
You can do that.
I think that'll be fun.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know. I'm just gonna see if I can pull it off, but I want to do a live podcast. Well, not live podcast. I want to do a podcast at SIGGRAPH with everyone there,
right?
To see if they can ask questions or if they want to.
Oh, that'd be cool.
You know what I mean?
That'd be really cool.
Be involved and do it that way.
Yeah, like a group podcast.
Yeah,
have somebody out on the floor with a microphone that can go around and ask.
You exactly.
Know, have people ask questions.
Yep.
That sounds pretty cool. I'd listen to that for sure.
Yeah. That's what I want to do. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Good.
So it'd be fun. And that, I think that would be part of the, what are people interested in? Where are their questions? You know, what interests them?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this field is changing so much every day and there's,
right.
Like I said before, it touches in so many different industries, so many different ways it can be used to be useful to just communicate. You know, it's as important as learning a language, you know, to be able to talk to people in a visual sense, to get your ideas across and to sell yourself and sell your project. If you're able to visualize that, if you're able to show your building before it's built, show your game before it's built, or show your film before it's shot, all those things are so important. It's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, you know. And educating people is it's at the heart of that. And you and I both agree it's about the fundamentals and learning communication and how – to reach out and touch people in, you know, a non-physical threatening way.
You don't want to do that as a
no,
teacher.
You know, no, PETA will come and find you. But you want to be able to show yourself.
Sure.
You know.
Again, not in public.
Yeah, exactly. Not in a trench coat sort of way in front of a group of school children or anything. No, but you want to get your ideas across.
It's the way that you there's also a very rewarding aspect to teaching. It is one of the most immediately rewarding things.
Yeah.
When you do it's like oh, you work on a movie and you get to see it on the big screen. Sure, that's rewarding. But I got to tell you, seeing someone learn something and their little eyes go bing when they figure it out and being excited and knowing that you've affected someone's life, way bigger.
Personally, it feels great. It would be nice to have a 4-hour award ceremony every year, like the Oscars, to honor teachers. And it would be a lot nicer to have education be revered more.
Sure.
I mean, it really is the basis of a lot of things. And if so many society's ills could be fixed in a lot of ways if education in general became a much higher priority. And usually when you have somebody as a teacher, they're doing it because they love it. And that's why it's so special as a field.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't get into teaching because of all the chicks and because of all the money.
The fame and notoriety. And
exactly. I mean, good God. I mean, 15 years I've been publishing this book and it's, you know, I don't walk around or I don't drive around in a Bentley and it's because I want to, it's because I get this information out and I help a few people.
Right.
But I really would like to see this profession as a whole held in, not just talked about in a higher regard. Everybody says, oh, education is really valuable. Well, great, value it better.
Right.
You know, have politicians fight and squabble and make it part of their platform, not just putting words to it, but actually do something about it.
Absolutely.
You know, and there's a few candidates that come up and say that and actually mean it. And that's who I look to, you know, and I hope.
And putting value into knowledge, like, hey, if someone is educated, there was a time, and it still is a little bit in this country, where if someone is highly educated, they're looked down upon on purpose because they want to make that person feel like he's the enemy. He's going to make you look like an idiot. So therefore he's bad. I'm just a regular person with no education. So therefore I'm the better idea. And that's the thing that really frustrates me. It's like, you should be proud of the education you have.
Yeah, right.
And you should be okay with being smart.
Absolutely.
You know, and I remember when I was, you know, working at, actually, believe it or not, it was at Gensler. My first job was under Houston. And I went to Rice University, which is a very, very renowned university.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And, but anyway, I was happy about my education. I was very, you know, I was excited about it. I wasn't a big Rice fanatic. I was just proud that I went to that school.
Right.
But I remember someone who went to a different school. He went to A&M and goes, oh, well, you think you're special because you went to Rice. And I said, I worked really hard to get into Rice.
Yeah.
And it was because I worked really hard and because I was really smart. So why shouldn't I be proud that I went to Rice?
Yeah. And why should you not be proud that you went to A&M?
Right.
You know, why?
Well, he was proud, but he basically was saying that I thought I was better than him. And I was like, no, yeah. I'm not. Don't think I'm better than you, but I should be okay and happy about being Rice. People who went to Rice, because they came from higher education,
right,
tended to hide that. Because other people said, oh, if you're from Rice, you're a snob.
Yeah, right.
So they pretended that they didn't come from there. It was almost like, but I was like, you should be happy about being a smart person.
Absolutely. Right. And you don't necessarily need to go to college or have a degree to be smart and educated. There's a lot of places.
No,
a lot of people who, you know.
Absolutely. I mean,
brilliant.
Brilliant people.
Yeah, yeah.
Brandon Davis. I don't know if you know Brandon, but he was.
I know. I think I do, actually.
So he's really, really smart guy. I think he's at Weta now. He's been there for a while. He just graduated high school, right? But he is extraordinarily bright. Everything else he did was self-taught. Everything else. Including some extremely, he worked in special forces, so he knew.
Wow.
Yeah, and so he actually knew, like he was reading high-end diplomacy books. He basically could have been a diplomat if he wanted to. He was reading Foreign Affair, that kind of stuff, and so he knew a lot about the world, you know, economics, politics, as well as. He knew how to use Houdini and Fume and how to work in Max.
That's impressive, everything. Yeah.
Yeah, so he really knew his stuff, and it was all self-educated. So again, he was kind of always felt shamed by the fact that he only went to high school. I was like, don't feel shamed. You're clearly one of the brightest people in this room.
Right, right.
And that's okay that you can do it on your own as well. So
yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's important.
It is important.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. We're just at an hour, which is perfect.
Oh, wonderful.
How did that podcast feel?
It felt great.
It felt good? Would you do it again?
Yeah, I don't know why you made me take my shirt off, but you know, I guess I'll look it up on Google.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really just for me.
Oh.
Yeah, because this is an audio podcast.
But there's no camera. This is not a camera?
No. I'm going to take a selfie for later. But this is that was just for me. So hopefully you guys all enjoy it. Dariush is a wonderful character, and he will definitely be contributing a lot more to
this. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Yeah. I appreciate it, Chris.
All right, well, we're going to let the last bucket drop. Thanks, guys.